Leader!
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday the 3rd of November, the government will look to advance a number of bills on the order paper, including the taxation bright line test for residential land bill, the taxation annual rates for 2015-16 research and development and remedial matters bill. As agreed by the Business Committee, Mr Speaker, extended hours will be taken on the morning of Wednesday the 4th of November for government business, and as indicated yesterday, the House will rise at approximately 5:45 or at the conclusion of the new Green Party member's speech.
Gerry Brownlee with that preview of the week ahead when the House resumes after a week's adjournment at 2 on Tuesday. As the government's leader of the House, Mr Brownlee's responsibilities include delivery of that weekly business statement before question time on Thursdays. And that also makes him the government's chief strategist in the House. While the party whips handle the tactical aspects of debates and divisions, the leader of the House manages the government's legislative program. And Mr Brownlee has a bill in the works himself as the minister in charge of earthquake recovery. We'll come back to that later in the program. First, though, there was one select committee meeting during the adjournment, and Rhys Lyon followed the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee to Auckland for an all-day hearing of submissions on two bills.
Meeting at Auckland Airport's Novotel Hotel Conference Room on Tuesday, the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee heard submissions on two employment-related bills. One of those was the Employment Standards Legislation Bill, which aims to promote fairer and more productive workplaces with enhanced protections and benefits for both employers and employees. Making a submission on the bill, First Union's General Secretary Robert Reid voiced concerns about the bill's lack of provisions around agreed hours for employees.
There seems to be in the drafting of the legislation that someone, was it Rumpelstiltskin or someone else, who sort of has woken up Post-Employment Contracts Act and has sort of drafted the legislation as if we were in the old, more regulated pre-1991 position, where every award did have agreed hours, and it had often it was between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday to Friday, and you worked within those.
Mr Reid said the bill as drafted would not provide employees with assurance around the hours between which they could expect to work, something he said was a growing problem for workers.
That's the reason why if you're a Newlyn resident you weren't able to get into Bunnings a week ago, because of the protests about the quantum stays, but the employer wanting the right to change when those hours are going to be worked rather than what's currently in that agreement, which is that any changes are by mutual agreement.
The First Union General Secretary said that at best the bill was unclear around working hours expectations.
Because in the proposed bill, quite a bit of emphasis is actually put on this area, which requires an employer to ensure that an employee's agreed hours of work are included in the employee's employment agreement. If we take at face value, which some of our other union comrades or colleagues don't, and sort of our submission doesn't, but if we take it on face value that this is a genuine attempt to try and do something about gross casualisation, zero hours, zero control of hours, then much of it depends on this phrase, agreed hours. And it's in the legislation, but our problem is that the legislation itself really doesn't define that.
Mr Reid said problems around contracted hours were an ongoing concern.
If you look at our agreements now, even in some of our good agreements on the hours of work clause, because of particularly the period of the Employment Contracts Act, you could drive a bus through them. They don't define hours at all. They sort of say hours of work is 40 hours per week, full stop. Doesn't say when, doesn't say how, doesn't say what's going to happen.
And Mr Reid suggested employee dissatisfaction around work hours was likely to get worse.
Because the way that most employment agreements are going, both individual and collective, hours simply say 40 hours are available or 20 hours are available, but you can work them any time of the day and night, any time of the week, and we'll decide when you're going to work them. And I think the whole reaction against 0 hours was not necessarily about the zero part of it. It was against the zero control that workers had over those hours.
Robert Reid pointed to what he said was a glaring omission in the bill.
The new bill just says, for the purpose of those sections, agreed hours of work mean, but if you look at the next A and B, it doesn't say what they mean. So I'm really pleading with you to put in there what they mean. It's an Alice in Wonderland. It says it just means what the agreements say it means. But that's no use.
So Mr. Reid put forward a recommendation to the committee.
What might give you a bit of a hint, perhaps, is that the people drafting the bill have referred it back to what should be in an individual agreement. And it says, an indication of the arrangements relating to the times that the employee is to work. Not just the quantum of hours, like you've got 40 hours over the next week, it's up to me when I get you to work those 40 hours, but that part says time. So I really want you to look at that fact that if it is time and not just a quantum of hours, I think the bill needs to be much clearer about that.
First Union's General Secretary Robert Reid, while another submission on the bill came from Vicky Mee, representing the Social Justice Council of the Anglican Diocese of Auckland. She raised concerns about workers who struggled to make ends meet because their total work hours were not guaranteed.
What has happened is that they have taken jobs that have got hours, guaranteed hours, but low guaranteed hours, less than they can live on. And so some weeks they do, you know, they have good hours and they can live on it. But other weeks they're ringing up WINS on the Friday to tell them how many hours they've worked because there is a top-up payment. And so there is this yo-yoing, but they, as an income earner, need to get a top-up. And this happens so often, I suppose about 50% of the time, probably. And they have good weeks and they have bad weeks. And they've missed the rent, and particularly if a bad week follows, and then they get into debt, the landlord is saying, hey, and you know the tenancy agreement is under threat, and then we've got to try and work it out. And it is very difficult to work out because a huge amount of discipline is required to actually put aside in the good weeks, and that's what I try and help them do. So we've got, but there is no guarantee on it at all. We've got more and more people living in that sort of anxious situation of not being sure they can pay the rent, they can pay for food.
Vicky Mee also suggested that holding down two or more jobs wasn't always a practical solution for people who didn't have fixed hours.
At the moment, I have not got clients where it's actually written in that they won't have any other job, but the pressure of being on call tends to weigh out even considering another job. Plus the dangle that, you know, there will be more hours. But this, again, is the difference between a casual job. If you're a cleaner and you know you're going to a motel and if jobs are available, they're 9 to 12, that's it, then there's no problem with a casual job. You get an afternoon job or an evening job. With one of these contracts, which is you've got so many hours and you don't know when they are and it's on the end of the phone, well, you haven't got a clear space to find an alternative job which is going to match. So that's part of the issue here.
And Ms. Mee also had a suggestion to the committee of what not to do.
In Britain, in March this year, they brought in a law around zero-hour contracts, and there was quite specific conditions there about exclusivity. And in fact, it's only 6, 7, 8 months down the track, and it's found to have no teeth. So whatever they did in Britain, don't do that. Because it doesn't work, apparently.
Anglican Diocese of Auckland Social Justice Council representative Vicky Mee making a submission on the Employment Standards Legislation Bill to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee, which also spent Tuesday morning hearing submissions on the Minimum Wage Contractor Remuneration Amendment Bill, a members' bill in the name of Labour's David Parker. Both those bills are due to be reported back from the committee by the 12th of February.
That report from Rhys Lyon. And there are just 3 days before submissions close on Gerry Brownlee's Greater Christchurch Regeneration Bill, which he introduced on Monday, October the 19th, so it could have its first reading on the following Thursday after spending the minimum 3 days on the order paper. The bill creates a new legal framework for the next 5 years, replacing the structure put in place by the Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Act in 2011, and provides an increased role for local leadership. Although supported by opposition parties for its first reading, there was some disquiet at the short time the government was setting aside for submissions and their consideration by the Local Government and Environment Committee. Among Labour's Christchurch MPs taking part in the bill's first reading debate was Clayton Cosgrove.
Sir, as my colleague Megan Woods and others have said, we will support this piece of legislation to our select committee, and like others, we would want to see a full and open scrutiny and the opportunity for as many Cantabrians and others, because there are smart people all over New Zealand, to participate in the process. We are disappointed that it is a truncated process. Now, I know the Minister will say it's 5 weeks. I think that is the dates. However, that doesn't take into account, of course, that the House rises on 9 December. We come back in 9 February. The report back date is 25 February.
But Mr Brownlee rejected Clayton Cosgrove's complaint.
We will be voting for the 25th of February report back. That gives a total of 15 weeks between now and that report back, where the House could expect it would be working. So 7 weeks between now and the 18th of December, and 8 weeks from the 18th of January to the 25th of February. On that basis, sir, I think we're not cutting the short time short.
Not according to the number of weeks on the calendar, but Mr Cosgrove pointed out that some of them would be spent at the beach.
Generally, it's a protocol in this House that, especially over pretty essential bills like this, that the Christmas period is a bit of a no-go zone, because people obviously are focusing on families and getting away and actually having a bit of time off, especially those in Canterbury. And generally, we normally give extensions to cater for that, so people can either beforehand or after make a contribution. My colleague Megan Woods has proposed an extended period to the 24th of March. That should be no impediment to the government, because it still allows a report back period or an enactment prior to the SERA legislation expiring. So I would just ask the Minister to consider that as we go through.
But when that amendment from Megan Woods was put to the vote, Mr Brownlee enlisted the help of his support parties in the Chamber, ACT, United and the Murray Party, to carry the day by 63 votes to 58. And that was followed by debate on two bills which will enable some 40 hectares of the Riccarton Racecourse to be developed for housing, interrupted for the valedictory speech from former Greens co-leader Russell Norman. And as Rhys Lyon reports, the first thing that happened after the House returned from its adjournment was to have the swearing-in of his replacement.
The first item of business on Tuesday was the swearing-in of new Green MP Martima Davidson, as announced by the Speaker David Carter.
I have been advised by the Electoral Commissioner that pursuant to Section 137 of the Electoral Act 1993, Martima Mariana Davidson has been declared to be elected a member of the House of Representatives in place of Dr. Russell Norman. I understand that Martima Davidson is present and wishes to make the affirmation. Would she please come forward to the chair on my right?
Ko ahau, ko Marama Mariana Davidson, e ki ana I runga I te pono, I te tika, I te ngākau tapatahi, me te whakau anō, ka noho pirihonga, ka noho pūmau ki a Kuini Irihāpiti te tuarua, me tōna kāhui whakaheke e ai ki te ture.
Following the swearing-in of Martima Davidson, the Speaker made another announcement to the House.
I regret to inform the House of the death on 29 October 2015 of Dr. Bruce Craig Gregory, who represented the Northern Māori electorate from 1980 to 1993. I desire on behalf of this House to express our sense of the loss that we have sustained and our sympathy with the relatives of the late former member. I now ask members to stand with me and observe a period of silence as a mark of respect for his memory.
Then it was on to a round of congratulatory speeches for the All Blacks on their Rugby World Cup win over the weekend.
Mr Speaker, I move that this House congratulates the All Blacks on their historic victory at the 2015 Rugby World Cup. Speaker. Speaker, on Sunday morning, the country woke up at the better part of 5 a.m. full of expectation and excitement and a degree of probably trepidation to witness the final of the Rugby World Cup and to see whether dreams could become history, Mr Speaker, and whether the great All Black side that we had witnessed right up until this final could ultimately bring home the Rugby World Cup. Mr Speaker, in beating Australia 34-17, the All Blacks not only made history, Mr Speaker, but proved to the world what a great All Black side they are and how proud of them we can be. Mr Speaker, we witnessed what will ultimately be the final game for the All Blacks of a number of players. And to those, we wish them all the very best as they take their careers down the next pathway, whatever that might be. Speaker, it's easy when you look at rugby to think of it just in the context of being a sport and obviously our national game. But when it comes to this All Black side, one thing that they've proven is it's not just the deeds that they do on the field, it's in fact the deeds they do off the field. Who will forget the way that this team acted as great ambassadors of this country right through the entire World Cup campaign and right up until after the whistle had been blown when Sonny Bill Williams took the unusual and, dare I say it, remarkable step of giving his medal to a young lad that had raced onto the paddock. Mr Speaker, we want to take this moment, I think, as a House, putting aside all of our party political viewpoints, just to say on a united basis that we have enormous admiration for this team, for the captaincy of Richie McCaw, of the coaching staff led by Steve Hansen. We thank them for what they've done in terms of doing something that no other team has ever done before, and that is win back-to-back Rugby World Cups.
Honourable Trevor Mallard.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I think it's very rarely that I can stand up and say that I totally agree with the Prime Minister. I do want to put the thanks of the record of the thanks of New Zealand to the Prime Minister for being such a good sport in posing with Sam Whitelock, just to show the perspective of rugby players and politicians in New Zealand. I also want to put on the record thanks to a few people. Thanks to the people who initiated the Rugby World Cup. It was something that was done in the 1980s when rugby wasn't going quite as well as it is now, and it's gone in a relatively short time to being probably the most important individual trophy as far as New Zealanders are concerned. And I think that has been important in rebuilding the image of rugby in New Zealand and around the world. I want to acknowledge the late Jock Hobbs, who took rugby into the professional administration era. He got Chris Moller in and Steve Chu and Neil Sorensen and Don Tricker and earlier Dame Therese Walsh, people who have set a platform of professional administration off which this team has been able to grow. I want to acknowledge the World Rugby Award winners, Nihi Milner-Scudder, Julian Savia, Portia Woodman and Kendra Coxridge, who didn't get quite the recognition that some of the others did coming out of that ceremony. But a special acknowledgement for Dan Carter for his enormous contribution throughout a wonderful career. I note my colleague from Canterbury is saying hear, hear. He has broken my heart on a number of occasions as a Hurricanes supporter. But his career and especially his vision in the final and his skills in the final were the like of a fly half that I think it'll be a while until we see one so good again. Mr Speaker, we don't know yet officially the future of Richie McCaw as far as rugby is concerned. But if you ever had someone who could lead by example, who could develop a team of leaders around him that really made a difference both on and off the field, then Richie McCaw has done that. I want to have my final comments in acknowledging the work of Steve Shag Hansen. His dry humour is something which New Zealanders are finding very, very special. I'm going to be frank. When Steve first got the job, I had my doubts. But the first time I heard him speak, actually in the Wainuiomata Rugby Club, I had no doubts whatsoever, because what was clear was a ferocious but well-hidden intellect and a wonderful sense of humour and an ability to select for the ability to select for the longer term, which has meant that he has built a team that is really special. It is a golden era, and I, for one, hope that he will think very, very carefully about the possibility of being the first coach to take two. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I would
James
like to...
Shaw.
Thank you. I'd like to rise and add my voice and those of Green Party supporters who are also supporters of the All Blacks in support of the motion put by the Prime Minister. I'd like to just start by talking a little bit about the French, actually, because one of the great things about this particular World Cup was that it put to bed so many ghosts that we have about how we've played against France in the past. And I happened to spend that game in 2007 in a pub in London, coincidentally, as it turned out, completely surrounded by French people. Just happened to wander into a pub to watch the game, and it turned out it was a French pub. And we were pretty cocky, so to speak. We thought we had it, and our absolute horror as that game turned against us, and particularly surrounded by what must have been 200 cheering French people. And it was a sort of a catastrophic moment in our national psyche. For those of us who are fans of the game. And so in this particular World Cup, to have beaten France by a larger margin than we beat Namibia was a particular high point. But of course, the greatest high point was, of course, the finale on Sunday morning, which I also did get up to with many, many New Zealanders at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch. And just remembering the tension of the 2011 World Cup, when we were so close, playing coincidentally France, so close, and it could have gone either way. And again, in this one, putting to bed that ghost that you know, when it comes down to it, not only are this particular All Blacks team the best in the world at this particular time, but I think that we can say with some confidence that they are the best team that there has ever been, as proven by the fact that they have now won two World Cups. So it's been an extraordinary stretch for them. They are an extraordinary team. They are led by extraordinary people, both on and off the field. And I do want to acknowledge Steve Hansen and the support team, because I think that they have done an extraordinary job with a group of extraordinary people. I'd also just like to comment that I did see one tweet on Sunday morning from the Black Ferns, just saying, you know, congratulations, lads. Good to see that you're following in our footsteps, because the Black Ferns have, of course, won four World Cups. And so they're now continuing that trend, which is all great to see. So, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of myself, on behalf of Green Party supporters who are real fans of the game, congratulations to the team, congratulations to the support team, and well done.
Fletcher Tabuto.
Thank you, sir. New Zealand is proud of our All Blacks. The build-up was masterful and the excitement was high throughout the whole tournament. Individuals, players, stories held us captivated throughout. Richie McCaw, Dan Carter, Ma'a Nonu, Conrad Smith, Kevin Mialamu, and Kevin Mialamu, to the most capped prop, Tony Woodcock. We wish them all the best. Richie, whatever you do now, know that New Zealanders do support you. What has been truly great to observe has been the team, sir. The comments from the players acknowledging everyone, not just those on the field, but the support staff, the management team, everyone involved. It has been about a whole team effort. Throughout that team, history has been made. The most tries scored in a Rugby World Cup final, the first finals won by New Zealand on foreign soil, and the first back-to-back tournament win. It brings to mind the amazing results of the New Zealand Black Ferns, who have, as noted, won 4 back-to-back World Cup titles on foreign soil. And having missed out on the last tournament, they must feel the pressure now as they prepare for 2017, and I know everyone in this house supports them in their campaign to reclaim that title. And importantly, we would like to acknowledge Portia Woodman and congratulate her on being named Female Sevens Player of the Year. To the All Blacks and everyone involved in making this victory happen, you have done us all proud, and we thank you all.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker.
Marama Fox.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. I want to add my voice to that of David Hasselhoff and Kevin Costner, all of my other good friends in Hollywood, and, of course, the 51st Parliament, and congratulating the All Blacks on a mighty win. And I don't know about these guys who got up at 5 a.m., but I was up at 4 a.m. In fact, I didn't go to bed. That's right, because we were waiting up with eager anticipation, watching all the pre-match deliberatory about whether or not so-and-so was going to score a try or who was going to get there first. But we were all amazed at the Ngāti boy, the scudder attack on the Australian back line as he scored that try. In fact, we weren't amazed because that's just how we roll on the East Coast. But I want to congratulate these guys for their back-to-back victory. And I want to see them back again in 4 more years for the three-peat. That's right. I think three-peat is the new cry from this moment on. In fact, I'm feeling a little sorry right now for my other friend, Chuck Norris, who, though may have given his spirit to the Wallabies, he was not banking on 5 million, almost 5 million, spirited, provocial Kiwis backing this All Black team. And so I add my voice to those in congratulating Richie McCaw and leading the way that he did. And actually, I just don't understand how Steve Hansen doesn't become Coach of the Year despite all of the deliberation that's been had over that. Yes, OK, the Wallabies did try very hard and maybe their coach deserved something for that, but Steve Hansen is top in my books, along with Ma'a, local boy, my bestie and my selfie buddy. What other friends do I have? Actually, I have another friend, Kawhina Woodman, whose daughter Portia was recognised, as everybody said, as the Women's Sevens Player of the Year. And I want to congratulate Kendra Coxridge, the Women's Player of the Year. And in fact, the last group of people I want to congratulate are the Indigenous women's team who won the gold medal in tug of war. That's right, in Brazil. Gold medal for tug of war. We're just a nation of winners, and I love being a part of it, and I add my voice to the rest of this country in congratulating the All Blacks.
Mr. Speaker.
David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the ACT Party, I'd like to add my congratulations to the All Blacks. I think members will agree I'm completely capable of giving quite a lengthy treatise on why I and how I agree with all of the earlier contributions, but also I have the kindness not to actually do it. Suffice to say that I think the All Blacks are an outstanding group of individuals and they've succeeded at this World Cup, but actually for the last 11 years with an 86% win rate. That's happened in an extraordinary culture, which is reflective of the wider culture of New Zealand and something of which we should all be very, very proud.
Ex-David Seymour. I'm Rhys Lyon reporting for parliamenttoday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.